The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the MadTech Podcast from ExchangeWire. If there's a little bit more background noise than usual this week, it's because we're recording in front of a live studio audience at a bustling ExchangeWire HQ. I'm John Still, ExchangeWire's Head of Content, and I'm grateful to today's guests for making the journey across a pretty chilly London. First off, ExchangeWire COO, Lindsay Rowntree. Lindsay, welcome.
Hello, delighted to be here. I love how you said live studio audience, like anyone cares that we're recording this. No one's listening, they're just carrying on with their work, but yeah, sure.
Well, we're going to get the candle after put in some of my witty repartee later. I'm also absolutely delighted to be joined by Daniel Sickle, Global Digital Performance Lead at Zenith. Daniel, welcome back to the pod.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here as well.
Well, very lovely to have you. We've got three really interesting stories this week. So I will kick off with our first. Publishers are concerned about the sharp decline in referral traffic from social media, according to Reuters Institute's Journalism, Media and Technology Trends and Predictions report. 70% of publisher respondents say they are planning to focus their efforts further on their own direct channels. So the referral traffic issue, always going to be a big one that we talked about this year. Daniel, should this be front of mind for publishers, and how is the industry responding?
It should be front of mind for publishers for lots of reasons. I think as well as considering the reasons as to why specifically social traffic may be falling, it also should be looking at why all traffic is falling to their website. And then something else I was considering, I was listening to some of your previous podcasts, is just how that traffic's being categorized. So it may not, social traffic may still be coming through, it just isn't being categorized properly in the analytics of that site. So I think there's lots of things we can probably talk about subject areas here. I'd also like to discuss maybe changing consumer behaviors, audiences no longer consuming news content in the same way, maybe trusting sources slightly differently. Yeah, it's a very, very interesting topic.
Yeah, and on that, you know, you mentioned the trust and how things are changing. Like, how are you seeing that in your day-to-day playing out, and how is it impacting your work, do you think?
I mean, as long as I can remember, a lot of our retail brands almost all brands have wanted to shy away from news content and not being seen next to them. I think there's been a mistrust of news content for a long time, and also maybe the brand safety about being seen next to that. And we know over the last couple of years that the social platforms have also started to shy away from promoting news content because of the criticisms that they've had in the industry for how they're promoting that news content, how it's being curated to audiences. So there was always going to be a change. I think these dropping rates they've seen, 50-60% over the last year, that's been steadily dropping for the last 2 to 3 years. They've seen a big decline. And a lot of that is going to be down to audiences being very nervous about clicking on social platforms onto news content because they maybe just don't trust the source. And maybe there's some criticism that social platforms aren't doing enough to improve the way that news content is being displayed and the reliability of the sources that is being shown to audiences.
Yeah, Lindsay, what do you think? Are we seeing, you know, the referral cliff coming?
I think that we are. And I think it's interesting kind of what initially started driving it and now what is driving it. So obviously it was driven, you know, back mid last year, you know, Facebook kind of decided to change their algorithm to not prioritize news sites as much. They were kind of pulling away from courting publishers in the way that they used to. Yet Instagram and WhatsApp are kind of doing the opposite and trying to get more publishers involved in kind of getting sources onto their platforms instead. So Meta as a whole aren't saying no to news publishers. It's just Facebook, I think, are just pulling away from it. And some of the examples Daniel just gave there kind of are interesting reasons as to why. But I think that kind of caused publishers to go, well, we were really reliant on that traffic before. And, you know, they've lost traffic from X/Twitter as well. What do we do instead? And that and many other things going on in the environment have caused them to kind of go, well, we need to, you know, the promotion of third-party cookies is another example here. We need to focus more on kind of getting our own house in order, getting our own data, getting people to come direct to us and not relying on platforms like Google News, platforms like Facebook, platforms like X Twitter to come to us. I keep saying X Twitter because I just hate saying X, but I know I can't call it Twitter because it's not Twitter, it's X. Anyway, we can't keep relying on that. We need to try and find other ways of doing this. And we've seen and heard from some really like big publishers about how they've successfully done that. And now I think that they're seeing success through that and now going, well, actually, direct is the the best option for us. Let's kind of really capitalize on this. We are starting to see them kind of go into different areas, like having TikTok presence, like I mentioned, Instagram and WhatsApp as well. And that'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because they aren't natural bedfellows, in my opinion. But I think certainly we're going to see a lot more, not barriers to entry, but a lot more barriers to getting content, and the kind of the value exchange will shift a lot between what a consumer will get from a site and what they expect versus what they expect to get.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And a lot of the publishers that were interviewed for this have said that they will be shifting into video and into podcasts and looking at audio and kind of diversifying further their channels, I suppose. Daniel, do you see that as a big growth area for the year, I suppose, and how that's going to impact referral?
Yeah, 100%. Just before I get touch on that point, just one thing you mentioned, Lindsay, like how the direct option. So I think having that curated environment, a better curated environment for consumers in that direct, in their own sites, is very important. And I think that's maybe a shift we are going to see. You've previously had people talk about how retailers are looking to do that. I think there was a good example of Wellington Boots in the last couple of weeks. And that's the same thing for news content, right? Consumers don't want to go into a news website and see lots of news that they're maybe not interested in. And actually people are becoming quite selective about what news content they want to see, because the truth is that news can sometimes be really depressing, and actually most of the people don't want to be depressed by news content, and it's really a black hole if you go onto these websites and you just continuously read things that are just quite negative. So I think that's the very important development for news websites to do. And then going back to the point on external to their own websites and other areas or other forms of content they can produce, podcasts or videos. I think TikTok and like any video platform is going to be very important. YouTube, I would also put alongside that. These are the places that audiences are consuming content now. So it's very important that news websites start relying on building partnerships and relationships with those environments in order to validate the content they're putting out external to their own website.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that your talk about the kind of the different types of content that exist, like I think news publishers have long realized they can't just rely on news articles anymore. And we are currently in a very bad news cycle, unfortunately, and there's not much positive. So nobody wants to get stuck in that bad news vortex. They want to be pulled out of it and to be able to see enlightening and uplifting things. But I think that also, to your point about the different channels and the different types of content and formats that publishers will use, they're recognizing that the consumer today is not the consumer from 5 years ago that would have, maybe the New Yorker's consumer is, because they write, you know, really long form content. It's kind of really in depth, and maybe that the person that reads that is still the same. But actually, if I'm going onto a general news publisher site, if I'm going onto kind of, you know, the Daily Mail wall of shame, sidebar of shame, to kind of see what the latest is happening with the Love Island contestants, I don't say I do this. I'm not saying that this is what I do. I'm just using examples that other people might do. Not me, I promise. But the way that you consume, it's completely different, and they're having to adapt to that. Like, you know, and we've joked before on this podcast about TikTok, and joked about, you've been actually quite serious. TikTok is destroying attention spans, certainly for the younger generation. That will need to be addressed, because the generation that are going to, that currently read The Guardian or Telegraph or whatever else, will are very, very different from the generation that are going to be reading in the future. It's not, a news article can't and won't look the same. AI will play a role in that. Social platforms will play a role in that. The types of just generally kind of how we consume stuff will play a huge role in that. And they all need to be ahead of the curve and all of that stuff.
Yeah, it's, you know, are we going to see a rush of major publications moving into stuff like that, do you think? Into kind of using influencers to give the news, basically? You know, if like a major publisher has decided that they can report on something by using a short form video that grabs the attention, is that the way we're going to see going, and we're going to see ad spend in that region?
Please, God,
well?
No.
I was thinking about this on the way here. Just, I guess, you know, we spoke just before about younger audiences, maybe, and their over-reliance on influencers and celebrities. And something I realized that maybe is being lost in journalism at the moment is that relationship that people have with particular journalists that maybe you would have from reading newspapers, seeing the same name pop up there. I think that's been lost recently. And maybe with these other forms of content that news sites may start putting out, more video-led content, maybe that relationship with the journalist that's actually created the article could start building. So instead of inappropriate influencers communicating news articles, actually it could be more journalist influencers that people start building relationships with, who are more reputable, and that could have a better impact on reliability of news.
Yeah, that's so interesting in terms of, you know, it's just it's the changing of the generation more than the changing of the platform. It's, you know, where you would have seen your favorite columnist write once a week. Like, I mean, I used to read Charlie Booker religiously when I was young.
Exactly. And
now it's not the journalist you go to once a week. It's the TikToker that gives you the Guardian TikTok view in, you know, every half an hour or so, however frequently they decide to put the news across. But yeah, that seeing it as a generational shift rather than, you know, a perspective shift is actually really, really interesting.
I hadn't even considered that actually. We're kind of coming full circle on that front. It makes it a very interesting prospect. I like that.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye on that and see how referral traffic does go for the rest of the year. I was fascinated actually this week with Mr. Beast launching a full length video on X for the first time away from YouTube. With the proviso that he was testing out Elon's claims of ad revenue. So I want to keep an eye out on that, which may, you know, reignite some platform wars if it goes well.
And when you told me about it, I went, who? Mr. Bean?
that was your response.
Yeah, I didn't know who you were talking about. So I'm really on top of things.
Yeah, down with the kids, Lindsay, as always. Excellent. Right, I'll move us on to our second story. FedEx is launching a new e-commerce platform to compete with Amazon. Very interesting move. FedEx has announced plans to launch a new data-driven e-commerce platform, claiming that it will be the only logistics company to connect the entire customer journey by offering end-to-end e-commerce solutions for businesses of all sizes in one platform. The platform launch is expected for autumn this year. I'll go to you, Daniel. Can FedEx compete with Amazon? How will this work?
We were just talking about this before. I think the interesting aspect here is they are creating some kind of new marketplaces for consumers to come to, as well as obviously a one-stop solution for the retail brands that they work with. And that is an interesting prospect. I think people are moving more towards a better relationship with shop fronts. You know, I personally I'm a big user of Etsy, and I do that over Amazon in many cases where I have maybe a specific product in mind that maybe has a bit more of a creative element, and I do want to understand a bit more about the shop, about their background, what the materials used in that product. And that's maybe not something that Amazon does very well. It's not very transparent about that, and I think trust is quite low in some of the retailers that may appear on there. So if that is going to be an aspect to that from a consumer perspective, that is shown a more transparent a marketplace for consumers and retailers, that sounds great.
Yeah, really interesting. Lindsay, how do you feel about this one?
Yeah, I can't quite work out what it's going to look like. I'm confused by, because I read the headline, and the headline, I can't remember what the headline was, but so I won't share it. But I read the headline and thought, oh, they're going to actually launch their own like marketplace, like Amazon, like a shop front that sellers can sell on, and it'll be like Amazon. And then I read the article and was like, no, that's not what's happening. They're actually just creating an end-to-end platform to manage the supply chain for businesses to be able to sell their stuff to customers. It made me then think of the shop app that obviously Shopify owns and runs, which allows you to kind of implement, what's the word? Integrate. There we go. I'm quite tired. Integrate the kind of the payment system, so if you can log into shop rather than the actual retailer itself. And then if I go into my shop app, I can see if it's been delivered, and I can see what the process, and I can see how many green points I've got, whatever, like how many trees have been planted or whatever it is. And I can also see other shop fronts from other businesses, D2C businesses, that are similar to what I've bought from previously. And I love the shop app. I use it all the time. And even Amazon connects to shop. So it made me laugh at that, because Amazon and FedEx apparently are in a kind of battle royale and just keep annoying each other. And FedEx will say, I'm not going to ship any Amazon stuff. And Amazon will say, we're not going to use FedEx. We're not allowing any of our customers to use FedEx, and then vice versa. It just sounds hilarious to me. But it sounds like if they do that, and they allow people to actually see they allow me as a consumer to see different retailers and be able to kind of, there's a discoverability element to it that can make it very interesting. I mean, it's interesting either way, but I think FedEx in this are trying to really compete with Amazon. And I read that in 2022, Amazon did shipped more deliveries than FedEx and UPS combined. So I feel like maybe you should find somebody that's more in your lane than Amazon if you really want to compete, because I don't think you're going to do that with this, but I do think it's interesting. I think it could build into something bigger. But when you've got Shopify doing what they do and Amazon doing what they do, and everything seems to plug in very well already, most people are annoyed with most couriers anyway, and FedEx is definitely one of them. How can you change that stance, and will brands will sellers want to go with you over and above the likes of Amazon Logistics, where they probably already have quite a good deal in place? Well, probably don't, because most hate Amazon. Like, it's a love-hate relationship with Amazon and retailers, isn't it? So maybe they might go, well, if FedEx offer me all of this, I'll go with them instead because they're more trustworthy. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a lot of interesting points are there. Particularly, we talk a lot about the Amazon's tentacles that reach across every aspect of modern business anyway. But yeah, Daniel, I saw you nodding along with Lindsay there. You feel, how do you see that as competition with Amazon?
I think that, yeah, some of the points you've made are very, very true, that having a one-stop shop to aggregate lots of different retailer brands into one place, seeing that and that post-purchase journey seems to be quite important as well, knowing when your product's going to be delivered, having that all in one place. When I was reading about this, there's a lot of criticism about FedEx and about delivery times and inconsistency, etc. I think Amazon doesn't have that. People don't have those same criticisms. You expect Amazon to be within 24 hours. There are enough drivers that around to deliver them. Actually, I had some packages delivered the other day from eBay and Amazon by the same driver. So actually, you've got these delivery companies that are now aggregating multiple solutions into one. So I am interested to see how the FedEx offering is going to be that different, if people actually want it or need it, and is it going to be more beneficial to the retailer brands they're working with, or is it going to be more beneficial to the consumer? And I don't think enough content has been spoken about yet in this press release.
I agree. Daniel puts things very eloquently versus me. He articulates things and I just tend to ramble about them. But my point gets across eventually. But yeah, I totally agree with you. I think there's not enough information about it yet. I wasn't even sure what the name of it was. I think it's FDX, but that wasn't even clear in the article. So I'm interested to see what it will do, because I think there are opportunities that can even play into advertising and media in some respect as well. If they are trying to create a shopfront, there's stuff they can do there. So it could end up being a very interesting platform.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it does, again, goes back to kind of, have they taken on the wrong enemy here? Is it the right area for FedEx to be really trying to do some damage in the marketplace? And Daniel, your point that it's going to come down to the experience for the consumer. And with Amazon able to, like, you know, just a worn cliche that I use a lot on the podcast, but my daughter's nappies, if I can guarantee they come the next day, then I'll use that service. It's dead easy.
One of the things that the article spoke about is like transparency in the fulfillment chain, is just understanding, you know, where your products are coming from and how they get to you. I remember a few years ago, supermarket retailers were talking about adding QR codes to, you know, vegetables so that you could see every single step, and it was going to use lots of technology in order to show you where things have come from, how long they've taken, the cost of getting them. But I actually don't know if people want to know that information, because it may depress you a little bit, how long it's taken you to get somewhere, how long that fruit's been frozen from when it was picked from the tree to when you're eating it. So I just wonder whether they'll bring this out, consumers will turn their nose up at it because it's giving them transparency that they didn't want.
Yeah, no one really wants to know how the sausage is made.
Exactly what I was going to say. Absolutely not. Only if it's like organic and really local, then I'd be like, oh, wonderful, my food came from 5 miles away, but not from 5,500,000 million miles away, and it was flown and shipped and then frozen for 3 weeks and then defrosted and then frozen again. No, I'm right, thanks.
Yeah, the sense of self-satisfaction that comes with your lovely fruit and nut breakfast would be smashed in a heartbeat.
Well,
Lindsay,
you know, I do enjoy a fruit and nut and yogurt breakfast. It's very satisfying of a morning.
Well, I hope you can continue to, even when you've checked the supply chain for those particular items.
I might need to find new suppliers.
Thank you, FedEx. Cool. Right. I'm going to move on to our final story for today. You know, we spoke a little bit about good news stories earlier. AI is going to hit 40% of jobs and worsen inequality, say the IMF.
Happy days.
According to analysis by the IMF, AI is set to affect nearly 40% of all jobs. Kristalina Georgieva, IMF's managing director, has said that AI will likely worsen overall inequality. It's estimated that AI will affect a higher number of jobs in more advanced economies, around 60%, versus lower income countries, 26%. Daniel, how concerning is this news?
I'd say it's quite concerning for good and bad reasons. Yes. So I'd start with the negative. I think that the heightened inequality that may come from the implementation of AI is concerning. It's on us as an industry, regulators, to protect populations that may currently be doing, performing roles and jobs that may be scrapped with AI. I mean, I was reading things, the list of jobs that may, maybe scrapped from this copywriting, content writing, etc. is another one. That is quite concerning, for example. Like, we know that it's very costly for content writers to constantly be producing the amount of content that consumers need and are consuming at the moment. And actually they're outsourced. They're outsourced to parts of the world where that labor is much cheaper. So it is concerning. And I think that we do need to look at solutions to how we protect their roles and find other ways for them, for populations to add value. That may currently be doing tasks that may be deemed menial in some of the more advanced countries. But then again, I think that that will help evolve and advance our relationship with more outsourced companies or more outsourced roles. And we shouldn't shy away from change. Change is good. And maybe there's potentially an over-reliance at the moment on cheaper labor in other parts of the world. And actually, those people are probably just as capable as we are of producing work that requires more thinking, is more advanced than maybe just simple plain content writing.
Yeah. Lindsay, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with all of Daniel's points. I think there's a lot of fear around the potential impact of AI at this stage. It's still really new. And I was reading something the other day about, you know, AI feels much more like a discovery than an invention. And we aren't quite sure what we've discovered yet and how much it can grow and what we can do with it, rather than us having invented it and knowing how to control it. Like, that's not what's happening. And I think that that's causing a lot of fear in people. I mean, Daniel, do you think you're going to lose your job because of AI?
I don't know.
No, I don't think I'll lose my job because of AI. John, of the three of us, you're most likely to, because you work in a content role. But yes. I don't think you're going to lose your job because of AI. But it'll just help you be able to do your job better, is what I feel like. And we talked about this on the podcast. We touched on this last week as well. There's this notion of any kind of technology is bad and will replace the human ability to do something. I think it will just evolve the human's ability to do something. It just make it easier, make them be able to do more exciting things. It'll mean we can streamline things and actually kind of do things better, do at a lower cost. And that's important. And that's kind of, you know, where the Industrial Revolution started in the whatever hundreds it was. That's what we're kind of, this is the evolution of that, basically. And I'm not worried. I'm really not worried.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, I am going to, my plan is to make friends with the machines. I'm going to learn how to use AI and become its master before it replaces me. But yeah, content team, I'm looking at you. Let's reskill quickly. As from our chief operations officer, we're in trouble. No, I think
you definitely are.
Oh Lord, I know. Yeah, I think it's a totally fair point. Until you mentioned it, I wasn't really worried about my job, because I feel like we are learning how to harness a tool now rather than seeing something that can potentially replace us. But the concerns, like Daniel, what you mentioned, it's obviously like the inequality, the potential for enhancing inequality is there, because it is the so-called lower skilled areas that will be automated and automated quickly. And it's up to us to, you know, like you say, we embrace change, but how rapidly could really affect an awful lot of people and an awful lot of economies. So definitely one to consider. In terms of the adoption of AI, particularly, you know, in agency world, how have you seen it impact your day to day so far?
Mainly in a really positive way. I think that when it comes to, you know, I've come from a performance background for the majority of my career. So when it comes to understanding the data that goes behind that performance, is the most important part of what I do. So the analysis of that data, the collection, the analysis, and then also the visualizing of that data, it's only been benefited from AI in the last few years. I've seen platforms, big platforms like Google and Facebook, automate some of the performance tools they have. So actually, it's a plug and play. You give them a load of money, and actually the decision making that maybe was a little bit more manual, more time consuming, not streamlined, less efficient, is now much more automated via AI, and the AI will make decisions about how much budget to invest in that creative against that audience. It's helping us test more. It's freeing up more budget for testing because of the efficiencies that are being generated in what I would call maybe some foundation performance campaigns. And that's incredibly beneficial as well. Ultimately, like we, and same as content, we will remain in charge of overall implementation of strategy, of budget implementation as a whole. But on the smaller level and smaller scales, AI is really benefiting, creating those efficiencies to help me do my job better. And you asked me whether I'd lose my job. I'd say 50% of my job is relationship management, relationship building, the emotional intelligence that I need to sit in a room with you guys in a lovely bustling office. that AI will never replace that. And that's something that I think, you know, that's the value we should be talking about. That's the value that people will always add over AI. And when we talk about how we regulate, when we talk about how we implement, relationships will always be a core part of the value that can be added on top of AI optimization and automation.
Yeah, you know, the lifeblood of the industry. Lindsay, how are you planning to replace me?
How am I planning to replace you? When? Because sooner rather than later, if possible. Ideally, I need to put a plan in place, but yeah, the wheels are in motion, John. Don't you worry. Yeah.
Understood.
but no, I do think that, and I don't want to. It sounds like I was diminishing or ignoring the kind of the potential issues that could arise with AI and kind of, you know, the lower skilled work and the kind of certain economies that could be affected by this. This is where, and we talked again a lot about this, not just on the podcast, but generally across our industry and the world. Like, this is where the evolution of these kinds of tools need to work together with regulation and with government to ensure that where those things are happening, we're not seeing an increase in unemployment rates, not seeing a reduction in salaries or wages, and that it doesn't affect things like cost of living, because that's all something that, and again, that's, that applies to everything. Like, so much can change because of regulation, but it's regulation that forces it to change. And often these people will do things, or companies will do things, because they can, or because shareholders tell them to get more revenue. And only when a government steps in, do they then go, okay, well, we can't do that anymore. Like, I use this example a lot, but Coca-Cola, the CEO of Coca-Cola was saying, right, we sold this many Coke bottles last year, but that's not enough. There's this many billion people in the world. We sold 500 million. We sold 5 per person. That's not enough. We need to get to a stage where everyone's drinking Coke every single day. And the only reason they're doing that is because shareholders are saying, you need to sell more Coke, you need to sell more Coke. If they were then told by governments, well, we can't do that anymore because it's actually really unhealthy. When the sugar tax came in, the amount of sugar that was consumed by everybody like fell by 48% or maybe even higher than that, because people like Coke had to remove sugar from their products and then kind of try and replace it with, you know, Coke Zero and then, well, obviously Diet Coke existed. If a government acts, those companies will continue doing what they have to do to make money until a government says, okay, still make money, but you can't do it this way anymore. You have to do it this way instead. And that, I think, will be what the step change in ensuring that we have a handle on AI at a governmental level and a company level. That's how it will be implemented. If we just let everyone kind of run ragged with it, then we are going to be in for some serious problems, probably.
Yeah, you've mentioned something very interesting there, which is maybe the lack of proactive mindsets in the industry, and we wait until regulation comes in, you know, everything from GDPR to cookies, everything. Everyone was shocked at these things rather than thinking, right, today this is happening, how can we better prepare for it? And I think that is what should be happening now in industry. We should be looking at where we do outsource, where we do use teams, where the wealth gap may be higher in some of the wider network in our companies. How can we make better use of their time? If some of those tasks that are currently being performed are a bit more menial, can be replaced by AI, how can that time be better used? How can they start adding more value? And then we'll be prepared for that regulation when it does come in.
Absolutely. Totally agree.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to wrap that up there and say thank you very much, Lindsay. That was a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Daniel, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm frankly appalled that we haven't had a live studio audience round of applause for our efforts today. Thank you very much.
They have no idea what we talked about, but yeah, fine.
That's, anyway, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for listening. This has been the Mad Tech Podcast.